It's all about just if you're a good human being, it just changes how you kind of think about everything. For us, genuinely, our goal is to do the best for our customers, for our team, and also for our business. So, and if you're able to kind of think about that and just have that as a key cultural value, and not like what's on paper, but what actually happens and how you deal with situations, it just makes things a lot easier.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Startup Operator Podcast. My guest today is Amit Mehta, who runs a very interesting venture studio called First Principles. They own and operate multiple profitable SaaS businesses. And on this podcast, we'll get his thoughts on what it takes to build a SaaS business. Hey Amit, welcome to the Startup Operator Podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, thanks Roshan for having me on.
Yeah, so Amit, I am a SaaS enthusiast, right? I feel like SaaS is startup 3.0, right? I mean, you had the dot-com era with Naukri and so on, and then the consumer internet era. And I think right now we're on the SaaS wave, I would say. From having seen multiple SaaS businesses, right? You have a vantage point. You understand what works, what doesn't, at a very macro level itself, right? So what are the essentials of a good SaaS business? You know, how do you pick an idea and a product and a market that simply works?
Sure. So I'll talk about, I think there are two phases of a company. One is finding product market fit. So going from zero to a million and then post 1 million, which is when you have probably found product market fit. So in terms of from that zero to one journey, I would want to say there are probably two key factors. One is if there's a founder who has actually gone through the problem him or herself and actually understand what the end user is feeling, I think that's a key differentiator versus SaaS companies that are extremely successful versus the ones that may not be. Sure, you can do user interviews. You can do a lot of those things. However, if you're using your product every day, that completely changes the way that you build the product because there are minor UX improvements that you're able to do that completely changes the end experience of the product. So I'd want to say solve problems that you've had yourself. And that's one of the key things that we have at First Principles. For any companies that we start or any companies that we acquire, if we are going to be partnering with a founder or we are founding ourselves, we're going to put a person in charge who actually is going to be using the product every day as well. So I would say that's one. And the second key kind of factor for success, SaaS companies to get to that million in revenue is probably one marketing channel that's going to work. So a lot of folks kind of pick, oh, hey, I'm going to do SEO, I'm going to do PPC, I'm going to do events, I'm going to do social. With SaaS companies, to kind of get to that million, pick one channel and execute hard against that one channel, and it'll get you to that million. So that is pre-product market fit or to the million-dollar journey. Post-product market fit, I think it's a completely different sort of game, and you as a founder or an entrepreneur need to have a very different mindset. Here, it's all about sort of scaling. And here, a lot of it is about building the right team. So having one right VP of anything, it might be VP of engineering, VP of sales, or whatever it might be, changes the entire equation of your business. So recruitment is important. And then building the right culture is also very critical. And I'm sure those are things that people obviously talk about. The third one, from a very tactical perspective, is being actually able to scale your products and people. And specifically, let's talk about products. Most people, when they're building MVPs or when they're just building a product, there's a lot of technical and product debt that they don't really think about. If you're going to continue scaling, you're definitely going to hit certain issues. And it's really important that you address tech debt pretty early in your journey, or it's going to be a recipe for massive disasters.
Awesome. That's a great list of things to check off. I'll talk about each of these, right? But the most interesting thing is the subject matter expert that you work with. SaaS businesses today, I mean, are built for a particular domain. They're extremely verticalized also, right? So really understanding, I don't know, if you're building for finance professionals or if you're building for, let's say, insurance or whatever, just simply having a context, right, helps a great deal, right? And you can also reach out to the 2 or 3 or 10 people who can make all of the difference for you, right? I mean, whether in terms of early adopters or, you know, product feedback or whatever else. So for someone who doesn't have that handy right now, how should they recruit this subject matter expert?
I mean, if they themselves want to be a founder, in terms of recruiting for the idea perspective, honestly, I would just say go. If you don't have an idea yourself, then I would want to say go work at a SaaS company until you have an idea, which is a problem for yourself. I shouldn't say an idea, a problem. And of course, you can work with a team as well. So if you have already worked with someone, and yeah, I think this is like going to go find a mate. You know, sometimes you just, to answer your question specifically, meet as many people as you can. And if it is them that's running their idea, and you're going to be helping them sort of make that into a reality, meet as many people as possible. Don't have a timeline, because again, that's probably going to be a recipe for failure, because you're going to try to optimize for launching a product rather than solving a real problem.
Right, right. You know, your objective with the Venture Studio is to build a profitable company in 36 months, and you know, something that grows about 50% year on year, right? And from running these multiple businesses, right, I mean, are there specific ideas or markets or products that you like? And if so, you know, what are some unique characteristics about these specific ideas or markets?
We love old stodgy businesses where tech professionals don't work in. So one of our businesses is real estate syndication. Real estate folks aren't the biggest adopters of technology, and it works out really well. We're working on something else in the insurance agency space. Again, not the first adopters of technology. So we basically look for mission critical software, something that's going to have low churn. So for us, having something be mission critical software that is going to be integrated into the workflow of a business is extremely critical. Where pulling that piece out is going to cause some business issues for that business. So that's sort of what we look for. So mission critical businesses in old stodgy industries are what typically works.
Right. And there's this whole debate about bootstrapping versus funding, right? And, you know, the operating word that you use is profitable, which is, again, something that, you know, not a lot of SaaS businesses, especially the hyper growth and the really funded ones, don't really focus too much on that, right? Was that like a conscious choice? And how does it influence your go-to-market? How does it influence your product roadmap and so on and so forth, being like, you know, self-funded or bootstrapped in some sense?
Sure. And also, I want to kind of start off by saying bootstrapping and fundraising are probably a false dichotomy, in a sense where bootstrapping is all about maintaining control with the founding team or the executive team. And fundraising is all about going as fast as you can. So I believe you can do and leverage both and be successful. For all of our companies that we start, our goal is to raise money, and we do raise money. However, we still maintain control in a sense where we are able to raise money. With that said, we do maintain control of these entities, and we set some very realistic expectations when it comes to what the outcomes are going to be. And we do really kind of things that probably no one does in their deals. So, for example, let's say we're going to raise money at a $10 million valuation or an $8 million valuation or a $6 million valuation for the business. We tell our investors saying that, hey, if we don't hit this milestone by X date, we're going to cut the valuation in half and you're going to own double the company. So for us, our investors making money is extremely critical, and we're looking out for them. And I think that immediately changes the conversation. It becomes about the business rather than, you know, let's work on this together to kind of get there. So that's one. Two is because we have the model that we have, we are able to fund a lot of the we invest in those businesses ourselves as well. So we're co-investing in the business with the investors as well. So anyway, to answer your question, quite frankly, in terms of you should be able to raise money and still be in control, as long as you're looking out for your investors and as long as the investors that you're working with have realistic expectations of where this business can actually go. And I think that's one great thing of building a SaaS company out in India is we are able to build really capital efficient SaaS companies, especially with the growth of product-led SaaS companies. You're able to build companies right from wherever you are. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. What are some metrics that you're looking at on a daily basis? You know, I mean, before we started recording, we spoke about how SaaS businesses are extremely benchmarked, right? I mean, there's a certain level you have to be growing at. Your churn has to be at a certain level, so on and so forth. There are multiple these metrics and so on and so forth, right? What are some things that you look at on a daily basis? Like you wake up in the morning and here are two things or three things that you look at to understand the health of a particular business that you run, and how does it vary over a period of, you know, the company's maturity itself?
Sure. Unlike a lot of people in this kind of the startup space, I'm not overly analytical. I'm an operator first, and I've partners that look, hey, are we benchmarked or not? With that said, to answer your question specifically, what I personally look at, I try to get the feel of the business rather than anything else. So one thing that I look at is the number of support tickets. I think that's really critical, is the number of support tickets coming in. One is the NPS score, which a lot of people focus in on, but how many support tickets are you getting in? I think that's one critical benchmark that I follow outside of everything that you may hear outside. So that's one benchmark. The second benchmark that I probably really kind of follow is kind of a team health score. So we send out surveys to the team to understand how they're doing. And not only is there a number, but there is information that they're kind of putting in. And we ask them things like, hey, what do you see as the biggest risk to the business? What do you see as the biggest opportunities? So honestly, those are the things that I look at. I think looking at metrics such as MRR or looking at metrics such as Net Promoter Score, those are really great benchmarks, but those are outcomes. And if you're more focused on building a business and focused on those metrics, those outcomes will take care of themselves. So I'm not ignorant to those outcomes. We obviously have benchmarks and things like that in place and definitely look at them. However, our MRR grew by X percent this month or grew by Y percent that month. It doesn't really move the needle for me. What moves the needle for me? It's like, hey, we got 30% more support tickets this month, this week. Okay, let's dig into why that is. Or we didn't get any support tickets. Is our support system not linked or is there some issue? So anyway, my metrics are always about process and metrics in the business rather than outcomes.
Right. So we've seen SaaS businesses mature a great deal over the last 10 years, right? And unlike earlier where people would build in India for Indians and then Southeast Asia and then APAC and then, you know, and then go to the US or Europe. I mean, today, you know, SaaS businesses are global from day one, right? So this whole building from India for the world, what are some two or three common mistakes that you see founders make and how can they kind of correct it?
Sure. So very frankly, I'm new to this India startup ecosystem, so I'm not really sure how we build startups here in India. So I wouldn't be able to kind of answer that question directly. With that said, from what I've understood is a lot of expectations from Indian B2B companies or Indian companies are they want one solution for everything. So let's say it's an HR software. They want it to do everything, quite literally, and very cost sensitive as well. So those are two things. However, when you go outside of India, people are okay for one function of their entire process to be handled by this one app, and as long as it does a really effective job at it. So I would say that I would really look at solving problem in the best way possible rather than kind of putting together a solution that does a half-assed job at doing something really well.
Right. Who are the first few people that you would hire for a business? Let's say post MVP, who are the first few leaders that you would recruit and in what order and what are some things that are important to you as you scale?
Okay. So we have an MVP in place. My assumption is we have a few engineers in place and things like that. Depending on what the product is, I would either hire a marketer or a salesperson and hire an AE who can help me take that product to a million in ARR. Of course, the founder is doing a lot of sales and things like that. However, having a really great growth leader, either on the marketing side or on the sales side, has insane impact to all of our businesses. So yeah, that's sort of what we do is bring in really solid people on the growth side.
Right. So you're seeing multiple GTM motions as well evolve, right? And with the maturing of SaaS, there's product-led growth, there's sales-led growth, very high, heavy enterprise, etc., and so on, right? What are your thoughts on these different sales motions and how does one optimize for growth irrespective of which path you take?
Yeah, sure. So I think every business has a different type of GTM strategy. For example, for some of the businesses that we have, product-led growth is not going to work. Let's say if we're working with insurance agents, I can promise you, and when I say I promise you, we tried product-led growth and it didn't work, and we literally had to bring in a salesperson to do sales. So it depends on who you're selling to. I think that's very critical. If you're selling to SMB, mid-market, or enterprise, I think that's a second factor. And third thing is, whatever you do, just be extremely good at it. Validate which one's going to work, and then just do that one thing extremely well. And with all the hoopla around sort of product-led growth and things like that, Jason Lemkin, the guy from Zaster, he tweets a lot about this, and he has a bunch of things on his site, a bunch of resources, where he analyzes P&Ls of enterprise B2B SaaS companies. And for a lot of them, even companies like Asana, I believe, and don't quote me on it, but close to 50% of their expense side or investments are in the sales and marketing team for a product like Asana, right? So I would want to say is product-led growth is a really great thing to kind of get started. However, I wouldn't discount a sales team, especially selling into enterprise. Yeah, if you want to build a business that's defensible, having a solid sales team that can sell into enterprises, that can kind of get you those large MRR or ARR contracts, there's nothing like it.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think at some point even Notion will hire salespeople to sell into the large enterprises, right? I mean, that's just going to happen. And it's perhaps the most loved product in the world, arguably, most loved new product in the world, at least.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're seeing a lot of gloom and doom right now with the markets and economy and everything. It seems like just a few months back, everyone was hunky-dory and people had these insane valuations for startups and SaaS companies and so on and so forth. And obviously, there's been a drastic correction on that. For founders who are listening to this, how should they think about a downturn? Like, how do they manage this, you know? Because it's an externality. I mean, there isn't too much that they can do about that specific instance per se. But how should a founder run their business during a downturn?
Sure. So in terms of this eventuality of valuations going down and things like that, most of the startup founders that I connect with or I would consider friends and things like that, we've all been prepping for this, frankly, in terms of, hey, if it's not this quarter, it's next quarter. It was an eventuality that was going to come in. So if you haven't prepared for it, I think pretty common advice, right, is to go look at your cash burn and see what you need to do there. If you need to make some strategic decisions, then go ahead and do that. That's one. Two is I would really first go on defense by protecting the existing revenue that is out there. So for example, the first thing that we did was schedule on our MBRs or QBRs, so quarterly business reviews with our enterprise clients especially. This is something that we talked about actively. How is this going to impact your business? And what can we do in this partnership to ensure that you're able to continue using our product? So actively talking to your customers about the recession or the downturn and how is it going to impact them is extremely critical. And then making literally our conversations are that, hey, it's better to make small adjustments now rather than massive adjustments 6 or 9 months later. So tell us about what's going on in your business and tell us how we can actually help. So I would say that in terms of protecting our revenue, A. And then B is about expanding the existing revenue base. So if you have a customer, it's obviously easier to sell to an existing customer. So go sell, cross-sell, upsell to your existing customer, and then look for net new sales. So those are the kind of the four things that I would look at. First is ensure you have runway, make strategic decisions you need to. B is talk to your existing customers and make sure that you're able to count on that revenue. And if you're not going to be able to count on it, you should know. And then third is increasing revenue through upsells and cross-sells to the existing customer base. And then fourth is net new. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think the third point that you mentioned becomes super important, especially during a downturn, right? Retaining your existing customers and also growing those accounts. Because oftentimes, I think in SaaS, you leave a lot of money at the table even when you close a deal, right? I mean, there's just so much more that you can really mine. And somehow building a support, post-sales, customer success function, right? I mean, it is a non-trivial thing. It's certainly more difficult than building some of the other functions, I feel personally, right? Because, you know, templates are few and far in between, right? And what works for you may not work for someone else, etc. Your thoughts on, you know, how one can build a good sort of a post-sales or customer success business, you know, function?
Sure. I think it just starts from a culture perspective from the very top. I think if the conversations in the company are only centered around growth and ARR and MRR, it's going to be a recipe, I shouldn't say for disaster, but for the culture not to be focused on just doing the best possible job for your customer. So I think customer success is not just a function of like a team. It should be org-wide. The engineer, the QA, all of us should be thinking about, hey, who the customer is and how do we help this customer? Like, what can make their life and job easier? If we're just focused on that, and if we're able to drill that down within our teams, I think it just makes things a lot easier. And frankly, customer success is, yeah, I'm sure there are templates and things like that, but literally is making sure that the customer is using your product and ensuring that you're helping them in every way possible. So if the entire conversation and culture within the org is centered around, hey, what is the best thing that we can do for our customers And in my specific role, what are things that I can do to help? And if there's a service mindset, it kind of just makes things a lot easier. So, yeah.
All right. So what do you have coming up over the next 18 months or so, you know? And I'm curious, you know, most people find it hard to run one business. How do you run four or five? How do you spend your time, you know? If you can give us a glimpse of what a day in your life looks like.
Sure. So first principles, we start, acquire, and advise B2B SaaS companies across our entities. We have probably about 130 people as of right now. So to answer your second question is, how do we actually run these businesses? We have really great leaders in place and we have really great processes in place. For example, let's say we're going to start a company. We have very clear processes in place of, hey, these are the things that we need to do to basically be able to get this out the door. Hey, these are the marketing channels that we can go after. Let's test them out and kind of go from there. So extremely process driven for sure in terms of how we execute on everything. We may be in the startup space. However, for us, process is very important when it comes to execution. We also have the leverage of a larger organization. So everything from HR to accounting to legal. If we need a template for a customer contract, we have 15 of those. We have a really great law firm who we work with who already has a template and they'll edit it for this specific business or whatever it might be. So I think that also helps. We've built a really great layer that helps all of our businesses succeed. And same thing with acquisitions. When it comes to integration planning, we have a very solid place when it comes to, hey, this is sort of how we're going to do integration and things like that. And in terms of how we run these businesses, we have P&L owners for all of our businesses, basically general managers and CEOs of these businesses that are responsible at the end of the day for its success or failure. And our goal is to just enable them to make sure that they're able to do it. And a lot of it goes with alignment of the entire team. A lot of work just goes in aligning what we are here to do this quarter. And as long as we're all kind of shooting for the same target. So yeah, I mean, that's sort of how we run all these businesses. And yeah, we have pretty great reflections. We don't call them reports, we call them reflections. This is not a reporting. This is not you're reporting what you've done. This is a reflection of what's happened. And let's think through why that happened. And when it comes to very standard and simple formulas, right? Like, hey, planned actual variance. And let's talk about why that is. So very simple processes that are extremely simple that anybody can kind of understand and alignment. I think those are very critical. In terms of what my personal days looks like, actually, I'm not very busy, to be honest with you. My Mondays are, I call them alignment days, my calls with my direct reports. Tuesdays and Wednesdays are my focus days. I literally do my own work. Thursdays are operational days. And Fridays are like culture days where I just do one-on-ones. I'm just talking to different team members and things like that. And 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Is kind of my, those are my focus hours or God hours. I kind of keep them to myself unless until something is urgent and important. And before I start work, I have a very strict, I shouldn't say strict, but a pretty decent routine that keeps me sane. So I start off, I have breakfast with my wife. That's the first thing I do. After that, I call my mom. She's in the U.S. Probably talk for like a half an hour. Go to the gym, come back, meditate, watch a show. I love Jimmy Kimmel, so I watch him. And then I start work at 12. So yeah, start my day pretty relaxed. And I think given that we're in India right now, you're able to start your day later because they typically end later as well. So yeah, I don't know if that was a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, that's awesome. I hope that helps. Very interesting, very interesting. On that note, right, I mean, how do you make acquisitions work? Because it sounds simple when you say it, right? I mean, all these interesting businesses, you know, you acquire them and then you have all of these different teams, whether it's, you know, marketing or growth or sales or product or engineering or legal or whatever it is. And it's kind of a shared resource across all of these different ideas and products and markets, right? But integrating all of these businesses is not an easy thing, right? So, and you know, just anecdotally, I think a lot of acquisitions fail, right? So how do you make these acquisitions work?
Sure. I think Warren Buffett, I think his saying is price is my due diligence. So price is my due diligence. What that means is, frankly, we don't overpay for deals. So we pay what we think is a fair market price for it. That is one. We're not going to try to force a deal together. And we're not trying to do like a, hey, let's do a roll up. Let me, and sure, that might eventually happen, but we're not going with a mindset. Oh, hey, I'm going to pick up this asset. I'm going to bring this other asset. I'm going to bring this asset. I'm going to make it all together and then sell it to a larger public company for X dollars or anything like that. That's really not the mindset. Our goal is to find really great businesses. And most of our acquisitions are, we call them special situation acquisitions. For example, the last company that we acquired, it is registered in the US, but that's it, a large team out in Ukraine. Right, the entire team's out of Ukraine, actually. So that's a special situation. So yeah, that's sort of what we look for, is we are doing acquisitions from a perspective of making sure we have a really great deal on the table. It's a really great business. And for one reason or not, that business needs to sell and someone needs to come in and manage it. And I would want to say, when we go into it, our entire integration planning, the first step is about building psychological safety. And even within our organizations, within our teams, psychological safety is really critical. And communication. The biggest thing that people are thinking about is, what does this mean for me? In good times or bad times. It's very important for you to let people know, what is it going to actually mean for them, A, and B, hey, you are there for them. And you may have to lay off people, you may have to cut salaries, or you may have to change their role, you may have to demote them. There might be a lot of things that we may need to do because that's the right for the business. However, if you're able to communicate, if you're able to build psychological safety, and they know that you're always going to have the best interest in mind for them, people do wonders, man. They go out of their way to help out and make sure that they do the right thing.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, really. It's that simple at some level.
Yeah, man, honestly, like for us, it's all about just, if you're a good human being, it just changes how you kind of think about everything. For us, genuinely, our goal is to do the best for our customers, for our team, and also for our business. So, and if you're able to kind of think about that and just have that as a key cultural value, and not like what's on paper, but what actually happens and how you deal with situations, it just makes things a lot easier. And focusing on inputs rather than focusing on outputs, and focusing on reflections rather than reports. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. Really great point, because I think 90% of the BS that you deal with is people related, and 90% of that BS is usually communication related. If you can really double down on communicating, setting expectations, and showing people that you're interested in their growth as well, I think they do wonderful things, really, because just that entire alignment as such, right? I mean, it does a great deal of good, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you one thing. So some of our major leaders within the organization, they came into our organization as completely different roles. So someone was in literally project management, and now they are leading growth, or a person that was in growth that are leading product. And the way that it happened was, we're literally looking out for them. We're doing what best for them. And at the end of the day, best what's for the org. And these people are literally leading businesses and, yeah, been here for the longest time. So I would say that's the key piece, man, is to just do the right thing for the person while also looking out for the business and communicating very effectively. Hey, this is sort of what we are doing, and this is why we need to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Amit, this has been a fun chat. I think we've covered a wide variety of things related to SaaS on this conversation. Before we leave, any books or podcasts that you would recommend?
Sure. So there are two books. So there's a book called Radical Candor by an author called Kim Scott. That is a really incredible book if you are looking to lead, especially effective communication and things like that. So I definitely recommend that for anybody. That's one. Two there is a book on self-esteem. I'll send you the author. I think there are a lot of books on self-esteem. But that book actually had a transformational impact on me as a leader, as an individual. And I think most founders, I mean, there has to be something wrong with you to start a company, right? Like, who starts a company? I mean, it's an insane journey, right? So I don't know what it is. And I'm making a general statement there. So, and we go through a lot as leaders, as founders. And before you're able to help your business, before you're able to help anybody else, I think helping yourself is incredibly important. And that's where I think that book on self-esteem, the author's last name starts with an M, just helped me a ton. Just to understand me, just to understand why people act in the way that they may. Those are two books I would recommend.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Amit. This was really, really insightful. I really enjoyed the chat.
I appreciate you having me on, and have a really great day ahead.
Before you leave, don't forget to like this episode and rate and review us on your favorite podcast platforms. It helps more people discover our content. We produce a couple of episodes every week and a startup operator roundup on the weekends. Again, all valuable content. Please share these with your fellow startup operators. Follow us on social media and subscribe to our WhatsApp newsletter so you can get all of this content delivered straight to your inbox. I'll see you again on another episode.